everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace. This episode, I'm going to be talking about Eclipse number 3 from the Top Cow Studio over at Image Comics. And also, I'm going to be talking about DC Rebirth for November the 2nd. So before I get to the books this week, I know that I've been hoping to go daily with the podcast, and that hasn't happened yet. I've been in the process of trying to change jobs. It's been kind of grueling, and it's taken a lot of my attention. But I am going to be changing jobs. It's going to be much more of a set permanent schedule. I'm going to have nights off. So basically what that means is that it might be a little bit harder for me to schedule interviews, because a lot of times the interviews I do with creators over Skype, you know, it's during the middle of the week, during the day, when I'm available, and that's not going to be the case anymore. But I'm going to have my nights free, which means that I'm going to be able to reconnect with Manny, hopefully, and have him on the podcast a little more. We should be able to do more podcasts on a more regular basis for you, talking about more books besides just DC Rebirth, which has been our focus lately. We want to get back to doing the Top Cow Chronology Project. We want to review more of the books that come out on Wednesdays. I'm hoping to get a little kind of a short daily news segment out on a regular basis. So a lot of plans, and we still have some plans to be hosted on another website as well. That should be happening fairly soon. Now that this new job thing has been sorted out for me, I will have some training to do, and I'm sure that's going to take up some time as well. But hopefully with the new schedule, you're going to be seeing a lot more content. So of course, we appreciate everyone's support. Thanks for reaching out and letting us know what you like and don't like about the show. So, like I said, hopefully Manny will be back soon, hopefully on the next episode, to tell us all about Stan Lee's Kamikaze, or formerly Stan Lee's Kamikaze, now Stan Lee's Los Angeles Comic-Con, which was held Halloween weekend in Los Angeles. Unfortunately, I had to work the old day job, wasn't able to go, still a little disappointed about that. I haven't ever been to that show, but I hear great things, so hopefully next year. All right, well, on to the books for the week. The first book I'm going to talk about, as I said, from Top Cow Productions, Eclipse number 3. The writer is Zach Kaplan, artist Giovanni Timpano, and the colors are by Chris Northrup. This book is absolutely outstanding. We talked about it before when the first issue came out. I think we even discussed the second issue. So the third issue is now out. It's basically something has happened to the sun, and to go out in the sun is deadly. You know, you can't, if you're a human, you cannot go out in the sun without protection. You'll basically just be incinerated. Your blood literally boils and your body kind of explodes, and it's not pretty. So that's the world that Eclipse is set in. We don't know the exact reasons for this change to the sun. It's kind of a mystery at this point. But set in that greater mystery is the mystery of who this... There's a mysterious character, the antagonist, who seems to be able to survive in the sun. We learn in this issue 3 how that's possible, but not necessarily how it came to be. So that is still something that we're looking forward to seeing. But I really love the fact that it's not being spoon-fed to us by the writer Zach Kaplan. He's not saying, okay, A happened and that led to B, that led to C. We start in the middle of the story. We start with this community of survivors, this huge community set in New York City that have managed to survive by staying out of direct sunlight, by staying underground in the subways system, the subway tunnels during the day, and they can still go out at night. And the powers that be have these quote-unquote Iceman suits that allow them to go out during the day and do things they need to do. Apparently, the solar power has obviously become much relied upon. It makes a lot of sense that that would be the case. And so, in this backdrop of this post-apocalyptic world, we're getting this mystery of who is this antagonist? Why is he killing people? Why does he seem to want to go after the more powerful people in this community? So it's a murder mystery that's set in a very interesting setting. Very strong character work by Zach Kaplan. The dialogue is very well done. The art by Giovanni Timpano, even in the scenes which are not out in direct sunlight, the colors and the world that both Timpano and the colorist Chris Northrup have created has a very washed out look. Everything looks a little worn out, and it makes sense when you see the conditions that these people are living in. Of course, things are going to look a little washed out even when they're not in direct sunlight, right? Because if these buildings and what have you are out and being exposed to these powerful rays of the sun, more powerful than they've ever been before, of course things are going to fade. Of course everything's going to kind of have a flat look. So the art by Timpano, very expressive in the emotions that the characters have, very detailed, good backgrounds, and it's little details like the buildings being faded and everything looking a little dirty and trash laying around. I mean, that those are things that would happen in a world like this. It's not like the garbage men are running on time, you know what I'm saying? It's priority, and right now the priority of these people is to survive, so there's little things that are going to fall through the cracks. And in the details and the backgrounds that Timpano creates, all those things are evident. It makes it feel very realistic to the story that's being created. So, as I said, this is the third issue. Three issues have come out so far. It's a very, very good story. It really hooks you right from the first issue. I definitely recommend it. I'm very impressed so far with the pacing. I think that a lot of times for a new comic writer, and this is Zach Kaplan's first published work, that it's sometimes the pacing is kind of the hardest thing to get right. You have a tendency to be excited. You're not sure how long your career is going to last, how the sales are going to go on your series, how much time you're going to have to tell your story. So it makes it a little tougher to, I guess, take your time and tell the story the way that you want to tell it so that it'll have the most impact. There can be a tendency to kind of rush. And Zach has resisted that so far. I feel like the pacing and the plotting are very, very strong. One of the best, most entertaining books I've read in a long time. So I think you all owe it to yourselves to check it out. Eclipse from Top Cow, top-notch book. And Top Cow is really getting a reputation for putting out these story-first books. It's kind of interesting in that with Witchblade and Tomb Raider, they kind of had this reputation, either deserved or not, of being kind of one of the bad girl publishers. I don't necessarily think that it was deserved. I think if you go back and read a lot of those books, yes, it had beautiful art. Yes, it was beautiful women. Yes, sometimes they were scantily clad. But the stories had worth to them. They were good stories. So I know in recent years, especially with the ending of Witchblade, Top Cow has kind of tried to shed that image maybe once and for all. But they are putting out some of the best books, and it's on the strength of story why these books are so good. Books like Eclipse, books like Eden's Fall, Postal, Think Tank, The Tithe. I mean, these are just incredibly well done, well written books. So if you're one of those people that when you hear Top Cow, you think, oh, 90s bad girl cheesecake kind of books, man, that is simply not the case anymore. You owe it to yourself to check out some of these books. And if you don't read any Top Cow and you're only going to pick up one, start with Eclipse. You don't need to know anything about any of the other books. It doesn't tie into anything else. It stands completely on its own. And it's been an incredible story so far. So kudos to Zach Kaplan, Giovanni Timpano, and Chris Northrup, and all the creators and the people over there at Top Cow who are involved in this book. It's simply incredible. All right, next up, I'm going to talk about Aquaman number 10. The writer is Dan Abnett. Pencils on this issue are by Brad Walker. Inks are by Drew Hennessy, and the colors are by Gabe Eltab. Aquaman doesn't even appear in this book. This is an all-Mira spotlight, and it was fantastic. She basically, at the beginning of the story, she had agreed to go get vetted, so to speak, by this sisterhood, this priestess cult, if you will, that kind of look after Atlantis. And at the beginning, one of them has a vision. Apparently there's this Atlantean legend of a fatal queen that is going to bring about the ruin of Atlantis, and this vision that one of these oracles of the widowhood has seems to suggest that if Mira were to marry Aquaman, that she would become this fatal queen. Now, they all kind of, it's interesting the way the visions happen. It's basically out there in the ocean. The ocean can know the future because it's out there, it's on the currents, it just has to be tapped into by one of these oracles. And so in a way, they all get to experience the vision that this oracle has seen. And what Mira points out is that, well, yeah, we all saw this vision, but we didn't actually see the face of the Fatal Queen. We saw the timeline of events. We saw that Aquaman is killed. And then the Fatal Queen, in trying to follow through with his wishes and continue his reign, ends up fighting against the surface world. The surface world burns. It leads to the destruction of Atlantis, and it's this apocalyptic future that they want to avoid. So the widowhood, part of the reason it was established, events from happening. And so part of the reason they wanted to test Mira was to see what her future held, if she had some connection to this Fatal Queen. Well, come to find out, based on the vision, they think she is the Fatal Queen. They forbid her to wed Arthur. As I said, Mira points out, well, we never saw her face. I would never do that. And she refuses to stay. She leaves the widowhood, says, forget this. And her initial instinct is that she's going to defy them. She's going to marry Aquaman, Arthur Curry, because there's no way that she would ever do this. But upon reflection, she realizes that maybe she needs time to think. She's not sure where Arthur is at this point, but starts to have a little bit of doubt. She starts to have the doubt of, she never doubts herself in as much as her becoming this fatal queen, queen that's going to end the world. But what she doubts is that she should be with Arthur necessarily. She still loves him, but does she want to add to his burdens? Does she want to marry him despite what the widowhood says? That's going to cause problem. It's going to put a taint over his reign. It could defy the Atlanteans. It could lead to strife. So she decides she needs to get away and go and think. Where does she head? I find this very interesting. She heads to Amnesty Bay, the lighthouse at Amnesty Bay, the same lighthouse that when the New 52 Aquaman series started that her and Aquaman were living in. So it's interesting that when she's looking for a place of sanctuary, she actually goes somewhere on the surface. She doesn't know that Aquaman was hurt fighting against the Shaggy Man, who was on his way to attack Amnesty Bay. So she arrives at the lighthouse. She finds a note from the lieutenant that she met in the first issue of this Rebirth series that her and Aquaman met, asking for a meeting. She knows who's behind the troubles that Atlantis has been facing lately. She goes to meet the lieutenant at a restaurant. She finds out that Nemo is behind it. So apparently all the threads we've seen in the Aquaman book up to this point are starting to converge. We see that the lieutenant had been under surveillance, I guess you'd say, from an agent of Nemo, an assassin. And so, what next? Well, once the assassin sees Mira arrive, he attacks. They manage to keep the assassin from killing them, but he manages to escape because he basically threatens the lives of everyone there at the restaurant where Mira had gone to meet Joanna. But now the cat's out of the bag, so to speak. Mira finds out that Aquaman is in critical condition after his fight with Shaggy Man. There's now a name. They know who the enemy is, or at least Mira does, Joanna does. So it looks like it's all coming to a head as far as a big battle, a confrontation coming with the forces of Nemo, who are now led by Black Manta. We saw, again, that storyline start to play out right from the first issue. So we're 10 issues in. There's a lot on the table. Nothing has been resolved yet. I love the fact that Abnett so far has just been additive. It's Aquaman trying to make peace with the surface world. Black Manta sabotaging that. The layers of distrust between Atlantis and the surface world build. That bleeds over onto Aquaman. He already didn't have the best reputation. Everyone already kind of looked at him well, you know, here's a guy from underwater, from a different world. How much do we really trust him? Mira had broken him out of prison, out of the holding cell he was in. That led to more distrust, led to the fight against the United States Armed Forces, led to Superman getting involved. Superman eventually let Arthur go, but nothing was resolved. It's still that level of tension. It's still that damaged relationship between Atlantis and the surface world. And it's getting worse. Plus, we had Black Manta taking over Nemo, wanting to use the organization to get back at Aquaman rather than just following along with what Nemo's plans for secretive global domination had been all along. Now add in this ominous foretelling, this ominous prophecy that could have Mira destroying Atlantis or having a hand in the destruction of Atlantis and the surface world. Now Arthur's hurt because of the actions of Nemo unleashing Shaggy Man. So it's a build. It's a slow build with all these different stories, all this different conflict, all this tension, all this drama. And we're 10 issues in, and literally nothing has been resolved. Aquaman managed to stop Shaggy Man. Other than that, no thread that Abnett has started has reached its conclusion. I find that very interesting. And Aquaman, really, the book is firing on all cylinders right now. So, it's a great book. Didn't miss the fact that Aquaman wasn't in it. Very much enjoyed seeing the spotlight on Mira and Joanna as well. And I can't remember what her last name is. I want to say... And I know she's either from the British Navy or the Australian Navy. Let's see if I can find it real fast. Joanna Stubbs, lieutenant in the Royal Navy. So, seems like she's going to become more of a supporting character in the book. I expect to see her show up in the next few issues at least. I'll be happy when this part of the story is over. I'm happy to read about Aquaman and the political machinations between Atlantis and the surface world, but you know, I've said it along. I'm kind of fed up with Black Manta at this point. It is a bit of a different take on him, being that he's the head of this organization rather than just solo mustache twirling villain. But I'm ready for something more. I'm ready for something else. I'm ready for Aquaman to face different challenges. It's probably why I do enjoy the political part of the book more right now. But it is okay in that it's not. I mean, Black Manta himself doesn't actually show up in any of these in any of the pages in this book. But I am curious to move on beyond anything that involves Black Manta, just because I'm ready for a change. I'm kind of Black Manta'd out at this point. But all that being said, great book. I mentioned that Brad Walker's back on pencils with his longtime collaborative inking partner, Drew Hennessy. I love it when we get Brad Walker issues. I love his art. I love how kinetic it is. He manages to show a lot of action and movement, even in panels where it's just somebody sitting at a table eating lunch. He keeps it interesting, either by somehow showing movement in the background or people walking by. His facial expressions are some of the best in the business. So I always love it when Brad is on one of the issues of Aquaman. Plus, I should also mention that, and I think I've mentioned this before about his penciling style, his panel layouts themselves. He always switches up the angles, even from panel to panel, to keep it very interesting. So, great job by him and Drew Hennessy. Gabe Eltab, who's been on the colors from the beginning, excellent job by him. He tends to use more of a primary color palette, but it's very consistent, very solid. So, I love the work that he does. He especially shines in the underwater scenes. It's not always easy when the setting is underwater and everything needs to have kind of a bluish or a greenish hue, but he does a good job of subtly altering the colors in the different scenes between the surface scenes, the scenes that are above water, and the scenes that are below water. If you just showed me a page and said, okay, is this above water or below water, even without the bubbles that Walker usually draws in there, you're able to tell, just because the scenes underwater just have colors just don't pop the way they do when Mira arrives at the lighthouse, let's say, and she surfaces from the water. So an excellent job by Gabe Eltab, just using that subtle shift of tone, that subtle shift of brightness to really differentiate between the two, between the surface and underwater. So Aquaman 10, solid, solid book. Next up, we have Batman number 10, written by Tom King, art by Mikhail Yanin, colors by Jun Sheng. This is part two of the I Am Suicide storyline. We see Batman basically invade Santa Prisca. He's, of course, looking to, I don't know if you'd say rescue, but he's looking to acquire, let's say, the Psycho Pirate, who, for some reason, Bane wanted and swung a deal with Hugo Strange to have Psycho Pirate delivered to him in exchange for providing Hugo Strange with Venom. So it's interesting, some of the dialogue devices, I guess you'd say, that Batman uses. He basically demands that Bane turn over the Psycho Pirate, or he's going to break his back. And he uses the exact same dialogue, the last exact same three or four sentences over and over, three or four times during the story, to the point where I found myself wondering, is this really Batman, or is it like a robot? Is it some kind of a programmed kind of thing? And so Batman invades Santa Prisca in such a way that you have to know, this being Batman, who plans absolutely everything out to a T, that he wanted himself to get captured. So you find yourself wondering. And again, it goes to show why no one is Batman's equal. Bane should be smart enough to know better. Batman comes, he lands. He doesn't have a giant army. He doesn't come in stealthily. He announces his presence to Bane. Hey, I'm coming. Give me Psycho Pirate or I'm going to break your back. Why? I mean, there has to be a reason he would do that. Bane doesn't catch on to that. Obviously, Batman intended to be captured. So with the dialogue device that I mentioned that Tom King used, it and the fact that Batman uses it over and over, it really shows determination. The determination of Batman, the fact that he's not going to give up. And it dovetails perfectly with the art by Mikhail Yanin. Now, I said last issue that the art is not as slick or as pretty to look at as his work on the Grayson series. But even though this is not set in Gotham City, where I felt that grittier style worked, because it's a gritty story, it's a Batman story, you know, it's Batman's in the same prison cell that Bane was held in for years and years, where he fought to survive. It should be a little gritty. It should be a little dirty. It should be a little dark. And Yanin does a masterful job of conveying all that. And again, with the repeated dialogue that Tom King uses, it really shows determination on Batman's part. It shows that he has a plan. We're not surprised when he escapes. We're not surprised when we see members of the team that he recruited last issue start to show up. And I can't wait to see where it goes from here. Again, Tom King has knocked it out of the park. I enjoy his Batman. I've said it before, I'll say it again. I enjoy his Batman better than Scott Snyder up to this point. And as much as I love David Finch's art on Batman, I think I like Mikhail Yanin's art just a little bit more. I think I find the way he has Batman express emotion, not just with the mouth, but with the body language, it's very, very strong. You know, David Finch is great at panel layout as far as making the figures jump off the page, making it look dynamic, making the most of using classic comic book poses, classic images, and you look at it and you're blown away and you're like, wow, that looks so great. That's awesome. I'd love to have that as a pinup on the wall. But there's a big difference between a beautiful image that can convey heroism or can convey stealth or anger or whatever it is about Batman that you love. Him striking fear into the hearts of criminals, for example. It's another thing to have little poses, little layouts, little subtle changes in body language that help tell a story from panel to panel. And I feel like that's where Yanine's art really shines, even to the point where I think he surpasses Finch in that way. So Batman hasn't missed a beat moving from Snyder and Capullo to Finch and Yanine on art with Tom King kind of pulling the strings as the writer. It's been absolutely incredible. I love this story arc even more. I mean, the first story arc was great. The I Am Gotham story arc was great. It maybe didn't start out as strong as I necessarily thought it would, and it wasn't what I expected, which is okay, because I had a feeling once the whole arc was done and looking back on it as a whole, it would fit well together and it would be strong as a whole. And the further we get from that, the further we get into this Tom King era of Batman, I look back on that first arc and as a whole, I see it for what it is. King laying the groundwork for the things that he wants to explore with Batman as a character, and it's great. It's very well done. It's very complex, and there's so many layers to it that you don't realize at first glance. It's not until you take it as a whole that you see that King is building to something, and it's become so self-evident in these first two issues of the second arc that, again, he's adding layers, he's adding complexity. I think he really wants to explore Batman. Why does Batman do the things he does? More so than just telling a classic comic story, telling an entertaining story. His Batman is a Batman of action. And then when you look back on the stories as a whole, you see the more cerebral side of it. You see, oh, there's layers and reasons why. The action is on the surface, but I think in the stories that Tom King is telling, that even though Batman has been around for a long time, Bruce Wayne is learning about himself because he's doing things that he's never done before. He's not going over the line or breaking his code, but he's doing new things. He's trying new things. He's determined to make change. He's determined in this particular story to save Gotham Girl. That requires Psycho Pirate. That requires him going and recruiting villains to work with him. These aren't typical Batman things. These aren't things that Batman does on a regular basis. You know, normally, maybe he would have gone and recruited members of the Bat family, like we see over in the detective book. King is taking it a different direction. And in doing these things, in having Batman try these different things in a different setting, we're getting to explore who Bruce Wayne is as a character, and Bruce is even getting to explore himself, which in turn is going to help establish more of the character for us to have insight in, which I think at this point, Batman being around for 75 plus years is pretty great. You add in the Mikhail Yanine artwork, you know, ever since he's come on the scene at DC with the Justice League Dark, I've loved his art. Wasn't totally polished when he was on Justice League Dark, but as he was on that book for a while, you could see the improvements that he made. And when he moved over onto Grayson, I absolutely loved it. Really slick, really clean lines. Showed a lot of movement with kind of the double exposure, comic book version of double exposure that he used to use with the flips and acrobatics of Dick Grayson. Haven't seen that kind of thing here with Batman, because I think he subtly has shifted his style. A little more gritty. But like I said, the body language, the emotion he gets out of Batman with just subtle little things that he does, and I'm sure he's conscious of it, he's really come into his own. If you're not familiar with his work, if you haven't seen it before, if you didn't read Grayson, if you didn't read Justice League Dark, but you're a Batman fan, I gotta believe you love seeing this guy's art on the book. Great, great job. Can't wait for the confrontation. Can't wait to see how Batman continues to play Bane, because that's really what he's done in this issue. He's set things up. He knows exactly what's going on. Again, I'm surprised Bane didn't realize it, that in capturing Batman and bringing him into his stronghold and putting him in the prison, that's exactly where Batman wanted to be. You had to know that, Bane. Catwoman has showed up with the ventriloquist. I expect to see more members of the team next issue. And again, I can't wait to see how it all plays out. It's almost like Batman hybrid Ocean's 11 kind of thing. Batman Escape from Alcatraz, because you know he selected each member of the team for a reason. You know they're all going to have their roles. So in that way, it's kind of like a heist flick where everybody has their role to play. And as I said, I can't wait to see what happens next. Great, great job, Batman number 10. Next up, we have Catwoman Election Night Special number 1. This is written by Meredith Finch. Pencils are by Shane Davis. Inks by Michelle Dalecki. And colors by Gabe Eltiad. Igor Vitorino also did the art on a couple of the pages. When I was going through and reading it, I honestly couldn't really tell what art he did and didn't do. So I guess in a way, I'm not sure where he helped, if it was backgrounds or what, but the art seems pretty seamless and it seems very consistent. So my hat's off to all involved. If anything, what reading this book showed me was that I'd love to have a Catwoman book written by Meredith Finch with art by Shane Davis, because it's a beautiful book. I love the complexity Meredith Finch brought to Catwoman, kind of giving us a little more insight into who she was as a child. If there's any nitpick I have about the story, the end was... It just felt a little rushed. Maybe she kind of ran out of room. So I think that's just a matter of pacing. You know, last thing I read by her was her run on Wonder Woman, which I absolutely loved. It's one of my favorite runs on Wonder Woman ever. She managed to make Wonder Woman feel more superheroic up till that point than at any point that I'd read Wonder Woman in the past. Granted, I'm not a huge Wonder Woman fan and haven't read a ton of Wonder Woman. I have checked in from time to time. So I just wonder if it was a little harder, being that this is just a one-and-done story. She had limited space. I'm sure she wanted to get a lot of those character moments into the story, and I'm glad she did because I absolutely love them. But, I mean, you only have so much real estate. So it's probably not the best-paced comic I've ever read. Still very enjoyable. As I said, the art by Shane Davis is spectacular. I love his Catwoman. Very much the Darwin Cook, Adam Hughes kind of version of the character with the goggles kind of on the forehead most of the time. His penguin looks sufficiently penguin-like, huge beak, let's say. Love the facial expressions, especially when he draws Selina Kyle as a young girl. It's all very realistic. So, great job, great story. Really fun, if not ripped right from the headlines with some of the things the Penguin says as he's running for the office of the mayor of Gotham. So I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed seeing Shane Davis's version of Catwoman. I enjoyed seeing Shane Davis's version of Batman. Beautiful art, very clean. Michelle Dalecki's inks over the top of her husband, Shane Davis. Always beautiful to look at. And as I said, Gabe Eltiad on colors. It's Gotham. It's night. Everything's dark. Everything's got a darkish hue. But the colors aren't muddy. So good job by Gabe Eltiad. And yeah, just a solid story. Very good basic premise for the story. Not the most original idea, but enjoyable. And as I said, just the ending. I mean, another page or two probably would have been perfect. It would have given Meredith Finch a little more real estate, and I think that the ending could have been even stronger than it was. Still a great story, a lot of fun. I recommend picking it up if you're a fan of Catwoman, if you're a fan of Shane Davis, or if you're just a fan of gorgeous artwork. So I really enjoyed Catwoman Election Special, and I hope we see more work from Meredith Finch at DC in the future. There's also a backup story, which kind of wraps up the Prez series. Originally, Prez was supposed to be a 12-issue series coming out of the DCU initiative from last February. Then it got reduced from 12 issues to 6, and then we heard from the writer Mark Russell that they were still going to finish the story. It was going to be 2 6-issue series, but I think the sales just weren't there, honestly. So they've given the back half of this Election Special to Mark Russell, the writer, and Ben Caldwell, the penciler, on Prez to kind of finish up and wrap up the story that Mark Russell was telling in Prez. I started to read it. I was totally lost, to be honest with you. I only read the first issue of the Prez series. It wasn't really my cup of tea. I didn't pick up the rest. So, as I said, I read the first couple pages here. I was kind of lost because I hadn't read that Prez series. It just isn't a story that I was that interested in. So if you did read the Prez series, it did get a lot of critical acclaim. There were a lot of fans of it. You're going to want to pick up the election special to see how everything wraps up. All right. Up next, we have Cyborg number 4. This is written by John Semper Jr. The pencils on this particular issue are by Timothy Green II. Inks are by Joseph Silver. And the colors are by Guy Major. Let me start off by talking about the art. I'm not familiar with Timothy Green II at all. This book has mostly been penciled by Paul Pelletier up to this point. We've also seen some art from Will Conrad. I wish, honestly, one of the two of them had done this issue, because although I cannot fault the storytelling or the panel layouts, I do not care for Timothy Green's rendering style. The figures just look a little distorted, particularly on the splash page. Proportions look off to me. It's a little bit of an animation style. It's very thick lines. I feel like the backgrounds are a bit lacking. It just wasn't my favorite art, and I feel like this is a case where the art hurts the story, because we've seen up to this point every issue of Cyborg, all three issues plus the Rebirth special, have been very strong. They've impressed me, being that this is John Semper Jr.'s first comic writing work coming from the world of animation. I didn't feel impressed with this issue. And being that I've been impressed with every issue so far, you just kind of look at, okay, well, what's different? Why wasn't this issue as good? It's got to be the art. I think that the colors by Guy Major are done well. You know, he's been on the book since the beginning, very consistent. I've said before, he does an incredible job with the reds of Cyborg's armor, let's say. Does a great job with bright splashes of color during battle, and lightning and electricity and electronic fighting, all that kind of stuff that we've seen in the book so far. But where the book really falls down, it's the rendering. I don't necessarily find fault with Green's storytelling. It never pulled me out. I never had to go back to the panel to try to understand what was happening. Again, the panel layouts, the angles he chooses, I'm fine with that as well, but the rendering itself, everything just seems a little stiff. The proportions don't seem quite right at times. Cyborg himself just looks, he doesn't have enough of a presence on the page. I'll put it that way. He just looks a little smaller, looks a little too thin, and the proportions just look off. It just, his head and shoulders look too big for the rest of his body. The artwork did not impress me. That being said, the story was great. Semper seems to have a great plan, a great idea. He's continuing to explore who Victor Stone is as a character, who Victor Stone has been throughout his life. What are the memories that he's missing? How much of a human is he? How much of a machine is he? Who is this villain who seems to want to attack Vic Stone at the very heart of who he is? Who is this villain who has replaced his father to get close to Vic? What is its ultimate goal? How does it plan to get there? All these things are still, in a way, up in the air. So I feel like some of the ideas Semper has had in exploring whether Vic has a soul or not, how different he is, and because of these differences, is he still human? Certainly you or I, we couldn't ever have memories taken away from us the way you can go into a computer and erase data. And taking that a step further, we couldn't do what Vic does in this issue and basically go inside himself like he's playing a video game in a way and vanquish these quote-unquote worms that are there hiding these memories, hiding these bits of data. So in that way, the fact that Vic is able to do these things, it really shows the differences between who Victor Stone is now as a cyborg and who we are as people. But the overall ideas, the fact that these memories are have been hidden from him to prevent pain, to prevent trauma, memories that he can't necessarily face, things that are traumatic for him, we can all relate to those kind of things just as people. And so a great job by Semper in marrying these two worlds, in combining things that are relatable to us as people, as emotional beings, and the fantastical idea of a cybernetic organism, a cybernetic human, a person who is both man and machine, and the way that he can approach those things differently than we can. That's what makes a good story. The seamless integration of these two ideas as we learn more than we ever have before about who Victor Stone is, as we're watching the story unfold, as we're watching Vic try to learn himself who he is now that he's cyborg. How much of his previous self remains? How much is new? How much can he trust himself? Is he still human? Is he a Frankenstein monster? All these ideas that Semper put forward right from the first issue of the Cyborg Rebirth series that he's struggling with, and they're lofty ideas, and they're interesting ideas, and it's a comic that makes you think, and those are some of my favorite comics of all. So I've heard the sales on Cyborg haven't been great, which is disappointing to me. I hope that the sales pick up, because I feel like it's a story worth reading. And a book like this makes me wonder, and it makes me question whether or not DC is doing the right thing by doing the bi-weekly shipping, by doing the two books a month. We had some news not too long ago that they were only planning on doing it for a little while, maybe through the end of the year, and then they were going to go back to doing just the monthly shipping. Rebirth has been such a big success for them, they decided to continue the bi-weekly, the twice-monthly shipping, at least on some of the titles. I worry it might be too much. They haven't rolled out a lot of titles. Everything has now come out. They haven't been in a hurry to release Justice League of America. They haven't been in a hurry to release Super Sons. We know the creative teams for those books. We know they're coming down the line at some point. We've had some hints that the Justice Society of America is going to be coming sometime in the next year, as well as the Legion of Superheroes. So again, I just worry about oversaturation. There's something to be said for leaving your audience wanting more. Another thing that this twice monthly shipping does, and in particular, this is what got me thinking about it, this Cyborg issue, is that it's not possible for an art team to do two books a month. It's just not. It's not the way the industry works anymore. The art has become too intricate, too involved. It just doesn't work the way that it used to. So you have some art teams, like the Dream Team of Booth, Ratman, and Dollhouse, who their book comes out once a month because they want to do every issue. And that's great. You get consistent, top-quality art that, especially in the trade, looks great from start to finish. When you have a great story, a great premise, great writing, like we do with this issue of Cyborg, and the art doesn't live up to that, the book can suffer. You know, here we have Cyborg where the sales are already aren't where I feel they should be because it is such a great story, and you're putting mediocre art on it. That's certainly not going to help sales. So maybe if you were to pull back a little bit, maybe if you were to say, hey, let's go monthly, Paul Pelletier, he'll do the art for, you know, just about every issue. Maybe he needs a fill-in now and then. That seems to be the norm. You know, regular series artist does 10 of the 12 books a year. I'm fine with that. And that's not to say that maybe Cyborg isn't one of the books that is going to go monthly when the new year starts. But I just worry. I don't want to see this fail. I don't want to see DC start out gangbusters with Rebirth like they did with the New 52, but then because of lack of quality, for the books to suffer. You know, they've generated some goodwill. They admitted they made a mistake with the New 52, jettisoning a lot of the history of the DC Universe, getting rid of a lot of connections that the characters had, getting rid of, honestly, a lot of what made the DC Universe so great. All those connections, that sense of history, that sense of legacy, that sense of family. They admitted they made a mistake. that's why the New 52 sales didn't continue on that upward trend from all the media publicity of DC relaunching. The quality just wasn't there line-wide. When you have to have these fill-in artists or these artists that haven't done a lot of work, again, you're sacrificing quality to put out quantity. From a business standpoint, that's never a good thing in the long run. So I worry about that. And that's all I'm going to say. Do I think Cyborg 4 is worth reading? Absolutely, definitely, without question. Love what Don Semper is doing with the character. This has been the best Cyborg series. The best Cyborg has ever been in a series, whether that be Teen Titans, Justice League, his own title, whatever. This is the best Cyborg story that I've read. The most interesting, the one that has explored Vic Stone the best, the most in-depth. So I'm definitely still in on Cyborg. I just hope we can have Paul Pelletier art on a regular basis. You know, it is a catch-22. It is a great Cyborg story, so of course I want to be able to have two great issues a month, but I just said it myself in that sentence. I want two great issues, not one issue with a great story and great art and one issue with a great story and mediocre art. If I had the choice, I'll go for one great from start to finish, from the art to the story to the plotting to the pacing to the inking to the lettering, everything. I want everything to be top-notch. I'd rather have one great issue than one great and one mediocre or two mediocre. If it means the story comes out once a month and it progresses at half speed as opposed to twice a month, I'm okay with that. All right, the next book I'm going to talk about is Death of Hawkman number 2 of 6. This limited series is being written by Mark Andraco, pencils by Aaron Lopresti, inks by John Livesay, and colors by Blonde. So last issue was kind of a setup issue. We saw Adam Strange struggling to return to Ran. He finally got back. Ran had apparently been attacked, or allegedly been attacked, by the Thanagarians. That's where Hawkman came in. This issue, we get a little background into Hawkman. Seems that he's just a regular old policeman on his world. We know that to be the case. Maybe that's why this version of Hawkman preferred to be on Earth, where he's stood out. He was much more unique, much more of a hero. We get a little background, as I said, into him on his planet as a policeman. He seems to get in trouble for taking things a little too far. We know that we've seen this version of Hawkman be angry. I mean, even the New 52 title when it launched was called Savage Hawkman. So there's a scene with him getting kind of dressed down, so to speak, by his superior officer. Meanwhile, we have Adam Strange exploring just exactly who is behind the attack on Ran. Alana, his wife, is having none of it. She believes the Thanagarians won't believe any different. And we see Adam Strange kind of seek out Hawkman in the end, because he doesn't think that it's really the Thanagarians who are behind it. So I feel like this issue really kind of, the first issue kind of gave us the setting and the overall idea. Now this issue has kind of put the players in place, and I think going forward it's going to be Adam Strange and Hawkman trying to reveal to everyone else who was really behind the attack. I'm not going to spoil who it appears to be in the book. There is a page in the issue that shows a classic DC villain kind of behind the scenes, probably pulling the strings, putting everything in place, wanting this war between Thanagar and Ran to go down. So we'll see if Hawkman and Adam Strange can foil his plan, so to speak. Plus, I'm interested to see, Hawkman as a character is all about reincarnation. And being that this limited series is titled Death of Hawkman, I kind of expect a new version of Hawkman, a new reincarnated version of Hawkman, to come out of this. Maybe a little less savage, maybe a little more classic, maybe a little more palatable, because we know that the Savage Hawkman series didn't really sell that well. So, first two issues have been solid so far. As far as the art goes on this issue, I don't know if John Livesay has inked Aaron Lopresti before. I don't know if it's purposeful. Maybe it's purposeful on Lopresti's side, but it didn't have the same detail as Lopresti's art has had in the past. It's one of the things that I have liked most about his art was that it did have such fine lines, did have so much detail. That's a little less evident here. So I don't know if maybe Lopresti was rushed or, as I said, if it was just a function of Livesay's inks. But it's not to say the art's bad. It's still great comic book art. Well done. Well, probably the best thing about it are the panel layouts. And the colors by Blonde, very well done. You know, this is a science fiction comic, so there's lots of special effects. And Blonde does an incredible job giving us kind of cool lighting effects. And, you know, between the transporter and the laser fights and all that, the colors really pop off the page. Bit of a primary palette, but it works for the book. All right, next up we have Green Arrow number 10, written by Benjamin Percy, and the art for this issue, pencils, inks, colors, all of it is done by Juan Ferreira. So I've talked a lot since I've started covering Rebirth about Green Arrow, just how good it's been, and this issue certainly didn't let me down. We see Diggle, Ollie, and Dinah escaping the island that they've been on a train that runs under the ocean. Murder on the Empire Express is the title of the issue, and it's really good. It's the thing that's cool about it is that we've seen some pretty well delineated arcs so far. You know, the first arc against the Ninth Circle, and then we had the Amico arc, and then we had this island arc start, and this next arc is kind of starting, but it's not, there's not that clear delineation that there's been in the stories before, because in a way this kind of plays off of what was happening on the island. So it's seems like it's going to be a story kind of in the vein of the Orient Express, Agatha Christie classic tale. So we see these three on the train. They're trying to keep themselves in disguise, incognito, I guess you'd say. So the story's interesting in itself. There's clearly intrigue going on. We're introduced to an old Green Arrow character who is maybe on the wrong side of things this time, more so than he's ever been before. That's Eddie Fires. So all in all, a solid issue. It opens up a lot of questions going forward about exactly what's going on with the train, with this important person that's been poisoned, with exactly what Eddie Fires is doing on the train, what his role is going to be going forward, because as I said, in the past he's been a Green Arrow ally, and here he apparently is the villain. So it definitely ends on a cliffhanger, and it's the setting is interesting as well, because as I said, the train is under the ocean, so they're stuck on the train, Oliver, Dinah, and Diggle. It's not like, you know, the train is flying through the countryside and they can, like, jump off and escape. They're assumed because nobody knew they were on the train, and all of a sudden they show up, and then this person dies. So the powers that be are assuming that they caused this death, and there's really no escape in a way. So definitely a cliffhanger ending. Look forward to seeing where it goes from here. And again, I'm loving what Benjamin Percy is doing with this series. I really like the sensibility that he's given Oliver and Dinah and the dynamics of that relationship. They play off each other very well. The art by Juan Ferreira. You know, I talked when I was talking about Cyborg about how maybe DC's hanging on a little too long on some of the titles with the twice monthly schedule. This title, in a way, is an example of when it does work. Because I was talking about having consistency of art on the Cyborg title. And one thing that the Green Arrow title has done, we've seen three artists so far. We've seen Otto Schmidt, we've seen Juan Ferreira, who does this issue, and we've seen Stephen Byrne. All three of them are do the complete art for the book. All three of them do the pencils, the inks, and the colors. And so it's their vision. You know, it's exactly as they, you know, pictured in their head. There's not somebody else coming along after them, you know, changing things or making it look a little different through ink or color or whatever. All the art has been consistently good on the book, like top notch, well above average. And so even though Schmidt and Ferrer's art style is pretty similar, Stephen Byrne's is a little different from those two. It's a little more primary. It's a little more animation style. But all, as I said, all three art styles are great. All three artists are incredibly talented. So in a way, I'm kind of eating my own words in that I said that maybe they should be pulling back from the twice monthly schedule, from the biweekly schedule. But this book is an example of one of the ways it can work. So I guess more so than pulling back from that biweekly schedule, they should just make sure that everyone they do have on the book does an incredible job, because I certainly don't mind, even though there is a noticeable difference between Stephen Byrne's art and Juan Ferreira's art, it's the difference in their art that I'm enjoying. I love the way that Ferreira's art in this issue, while very cinematic and very polished, gives such a different feel and tone than Stephen Byrne's art. Stephen Byrne's art, as I said, much more of an animation style, feels much more kind of comic booky in a way. But a lot of it has to do with the way that Ferreira colors. His colors are much more muted, rather than those primary animation style colors that Stephen Byrne uses. So the art is great. I mean, the rendering and the colors are really, really beautiful. I cannot fault his choices as far as storytelling goes. If there's any weakness in his game, it's probably the page layouts. He pretty much sticks to rectangular panels, and doesn't really do much as far as anything groundbreaking or dynamic with the page layout. So there's room for improvement there, but Juan Ferreira's art is outstanding. I love it. I love when he's on the book. I love when Byrne's on the book. I don't know that Otto Schmidt's a great artist as well, but I think he may have left. Byrne may have taken his spot. I haven't seen Schmidt do an issue in quite a while, so he may have moved on to something else. I'm not really sure. But this is just another great issue, another really solid issue of Green Arrow. Not the best issue, just because it's a lot of action. And one of the things that I've enjoyed most about the Green Arrow book is how much characterization Benjamin Percy, the writer, has put in up to this point. This is kind of flipping the script on that. There's very little characterization, but there's a lot of action. So it certainly is an enjoyable book, but I feel like I've learned so much about Dinah and Ollie and their relationship, and even Diggle and Ollie's relationship up to this point, that I want more of that. But obviously you can't play that, you know, the same note all the time. It gets boring. So great issue. If you're not reading Green Arrow, again, you're crazy. It's one of the best Rebirth titles. I think the best Rebirth title being put out right now. And I really do feel, although I haven't watched much of the TV show Arrow, I feel like they're really kind of capturing the tone of that show. All right, up next we have Green Lanterns number 10. What's been going on in the Green Lantern books is the whole Phantom Lantern, Phantom Ring storyline that's been going on. This continues that. We met the person who in this issue becomes the Phantom Lantern. We met him last issue, and we got kind of his origin, and we also saw the return of somebody who maybe we thought was gone. One of the iconic Green Lantern villains of the past few years. So those two kind of team up and this, we basically see the origin, the first time the Phantom Lantern puts on the ring and everything that goes with that. So it was a very impactful issue. It's very scary in a way. This guy's got, you know, he's got the ring on. He's going to be tremendously powerful. So the scene where he actually puts the ring on, we get his Green Lantern, or not Green Lantern rather, but his Phantom Lantern oath. We see him use the powers a few different ways. It's very scary. And at this point, I really don't know how these two rookie Green Lanterns, Simon Boz and Jessica Cruz, are possibly going to take this guy on. But I guess we're going to find out. So I had said in the past that I was out on Green Lanterns, but it's Sam Humphries, the writer, has really upped his game. I should also mention that this is another penciler whose work I'm not familiar with. He hasn't done any work on Green Lanterns up to this point, but the pencils were provided by Eduardo Panseca. Inks by Julio Ferreira, and Blonde handled the colors. So as I said, this Phantom Lantern, who seems like, in a way, kind of a version of Kyle Lantern, Kyle Rayner, the White Lantern, who could kind of channel all the different colors of the spectrum. Apparently that's what this Phantom Ring can do as well. So Simon and Jessica certainly have their hands full. And as I was mentioning, you know, I said I was out on Green Lanterns, but again, I feel like it was a lot to do with who the villains were, which was the Red Lanterns to begin with. Now that we've kind of moved on to something else, I have found the book to be much more enjoyable. And now that Jessica and Simon are much more on the same team and trying to work together and learn, the book has been a lot more enjoyable. I really like the concept of this Phantom Lantern, so I'm going to stick with the book at least until this story arc is done, just to kind of, because I'm very intrigued by what Sam Humphries has done, and I want to see where he goes from here. All right, the next book I'm going to talk about is Midnighter and Apollo number 2. This was written by Steve Orlando. The pencils are by Fernando Blanco, and the colors are by Romulo Fajardo Jr. And I should say that the pencils and inks are by Fernando Blanco. So this was an interesting story. I guess I didn't realize at the end of the last issue that Apollo was indeed dead. He was deceased. We saw him descend into some kind of hell-like place. I just thought he had been teleported to some other worldly dimension or whatever. But no, he's actually dead. That's his soul. So we see a lot of Midnighter's love for Apollo in this issue by what he's willing to do to find him. He believes that Apollo is dead, but he also believes that he can bring him back. So it was very touching in a way. And I also found it interesting that even in death, Apollo seems to have power. So I'm not sure if we're going to see that play out more or not. But this is definitely a softer side of Midnighter than we've seen before. So I like that Steve Orlando is really taking the time to explore who Midnighter is, explore his feelings, and explore the nature of his relationship with Apollo. As far as his characterization of Apollo, just a hero through and through, which makes you, in a way, kind of wonder what he's doing with a psychopath like Midnighter. But I imagine because we got so much characterization of Midnighter in this issue, that upcoming one of the issues in the miniseries will probably flip and focus much more on Apollo. And that'll probably give us some insight into just why he cares about Midnighter so much and why he's willing to do the things he does. We also got the reveal of the major villain in the story, somebody I haven't seen in quite a while, but In fact, I don't know that he's even had a New 52 version. But I think it's a good time to bring him in. It's a good time. He makes a good villain for the story. The power level and everything kind of matches up in it, and it feels right in a way. So the first two issues of Midnighter and Apollo have been solid. I'm quickly beginning to really enjoy Steve Orlando as a writer. So I'm definitely in on the next issue, and if the quality keeps at this same level or higher, I'll definitely be in for the entire miniseries. I don't care for the art as much. I don't feel the art is as strong as the writing. I didn't notice the art as much last issue, but oftentimes I'm feeling like these new artists, the ones that I'm not that familiar with, they knock it out of the park on the first issue, and then you know, you hope to see improvement as the story goes on, but instead I'm seeing some regression in a way. And I don't know if that's because they have so much more lead time for the first issue, or what exactly is the issue. But I didn't care for the rendering. It felt a little... it lacked detail, in a way. So, certainly not terrible art, but it does feel like it's a step down from the first issue. The colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr. are excellent, especially when it comes to Apollo. Even in death, he has this solar glow about him, which is just really, really amazing. And Fajardo Jr. does a great job of showing that no matter what, even in death, Apollo is a bright person, a positive person, a hero, and you're not just going to put his light out easily because you feel like it. So, great job by Fajardo Jr., great job by Steve Orlando, the writer. The artist Fernando Blanco has some work to do. Alright, up next we have Nightwing number 8. I had kind of mixed feelings about this issue. It's kind of the resolution of the Nightwing and Raptor plotline that's been going on. I've been on record as saying that I feel like Raptor is one of the most interesting characters that I've read in a DC comic in the last 20 years. So that's where the kind of the disappointment comes in the way this issue was resolved. I was really hoping that Dick was going to be able to reach Raptor and kind of bring him over to the side of Angels, but in fact, the exact opposite thing happens. And we see at the end that Raptor's beaten and broken and being taken away. So it was an enjoyable issue. Gave a little more background and insight into who Dick Grayson is. It gave us good interaction with Dick Grayson and Bruce Wayne, or Nightwing and Bruce Wayne. But I just didn't like the fact that they really kind of flipped the script on Raptor, and he kind of went full villain. So that wasn't my favorite thing. I was hoping to see him stick around a little more. And plus, it didn't necessarily make sense to me why Raptor kidnapped Bruce Wayne to get to Nightwing. I don't know. I understand that Tim Seeley, the writer... I didn't mention the creative team. Let me mention really quickly. Yeah, written by Tim Seeley, art by Javier Fernandez, and colors by Chris Sotomayor. So yeah, I mean, Raptor gives his explanation, but to me it didn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense, being that Raptor had this previous relationship with Dick Grayson's mother. It just seemed like he would have approached it in a different way. But, I don't know, I guess then you don't have the same kind of conflict and the same kind of drama, so... I hope this isn't the last we've seen of Raptor. I like him much more as an anti-hero than an out-and-out villain, as he's portrayed here. But it was an enjoyable issue, and if anything, I'm excited to see where Tim Seeley takes it from here. He's got an excellent grasp on who Nightwing Dick Grayson is. So we're done with the first arc, which dealt with the whole Parliament of Owls. Now we're done with this little second mini-arc, wrapping up everything with Raptor. So what now? There's not really even too many other plot lines like floating around that need to be resolved, so it really can be a fresh start with the next issue. Be a good jumping-on point if you're interested in Nightwing. The art, I'm not a big fan of Javier Fernandez. His art's very messy, very minimal backgrounds. not a lot to look at there. So I'm not a fan of this art. And in fact, I was going to be out on Nightwing, but then Raptor sucked me back in. And kudos to Tim Seeley for that. But now that Raptor's leaving the book, I may follow him out the door. I don't know. I'm going to pick up the next issue just to see what the next arc's about, what direction the series is headed. And maybe I'll stick around. Maybe it won't. It's too soon to say at this point. All right, and the last book I'm going to talk about is Superman number 10, written by Peter J. Tomasi and Patrick Gleason. Pencils are by Patrick Gleason. Inks are by Mick Gray, and the colors are by John Kalis. So this starts out, Jonathan is at school, hanging out with his friends, he bumps into a girl, seems a little bit infatuated, goes to the swamp, to look for a Christmas tree, which is kind of weird. I mean, it's a swamp, you're not going to find much Christmas trees. Decides he's going to go after it as Superboy, gets captured by, as it turns out, the girl that he had run into, who is, I believe her name is Maya. So, Maya, who is friends with Damian Wayne, so it's basically Damian Wayne feeling that Jonathan Kent, Superboy, is too dangerous to be left out on his own, left to his own devices. So he takes it upon himself to capture him and run some tests. Of course, Superman finds out, shows up, and he's not real happy. So the fathers, both Superman and Batman, decide to talk rather than fight it out, which I very much appreciated. But there aren't any real answers, in a way. They're still trying to figure things out, see where they go from here. And meanwhile, the boys will be boys, and they end up getting in a fight. And it's not just, you know, any old fight. These guys have superpowers. They're pretty much kicking the crap out of each other up until the point that the fathers realize what the boys are doing. And it looks like they could be in trouble. So I enjoy the dynamic. I'm looking forward to the Super Sons series that's coming up in 2017. And I think, in a way, this little arc is probably going to set up what happens in that issue. So I'm very curious. And John seems to be acquiring more powers by the day. So that's interesting as well. It'll be interesting to see exactly what powers he ends up with. Damian, I can see his point, but he's still kind of a brat to me in this book, so not a big Damian Wayne fan, and I've never made a secret of that. But despite that, because it's Jorge Jimenez art, and because Jorge is an amazing guy, super nice, super talented, I will be picking up the Super Sons series. I'm just hoping that Damian can kind of mellow out. I like him much more the way that Benjamin Percy has written him in the first couple issues of Teen Titans than I've liked him in the Superman title so far. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this episode. Once again, I want to thank everyone for joining me. If you'd like to listen to previous episodes of the podcast, you can go to our website, which is thecomicsourceblog.com. You can find all past episodes of the website there. You can find our famous sketch gallery. You can find links to Manny's written blog, my written blog. Do a lot of reviews and talking about comics and comic news, and all that stuff can be found on the website, as well as links to our YouTube channel, where you can go and watch episodes of previous comics I've reviewed with pictures and video and graphics and all that stuff. Please follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Also do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to keep up to date on all our new episodes and our convention coverage. Next episode, Manny should be back, as I said, and we'll be talking about his trip to Stan Lee's Los Angeles Comic Con, as well as a Doctor Strange episode coming up. That movie just came out recently, so as soon as we get a chance to see it and give everyone else out there a chance to see it. We don't want to talk about it too soon and spoil it if you're planning on going and seeing it yourself. So we've got that coming up as well. So once again, everybody, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.